Spend a few minutes really just to review what's going on at Ceres. Ceres is a commercial company, still privately held here in Los Angeles, the other side of LA, probably 30, 40 miles away. In this first slide, you said the right button.
Yeah.
Try it again.
Oh, damn.
I can use this. Let me use this.
For you.
I'll use this. Let me move the thing. So Ceres was established in... hang on, let me go back one. Established in 1997, so more than a dozen years old now. I mean, Thousand Oaks, not far away. Still privately held, with a number of investors supporting Ceres essentially until now. We have about 100-odd employees. Since its origin, Ceres has been a plant biotech company specializing in genomics technologies to bring crop-based solutions across the row crop and now the energy crop space. Today I'm going to talk obviously about energy crops. Some years ago, probably 4 years ago now, we and others saw a number of pressures pointing institutions like Ceres towards the bioenergy sector. We saw demand trends, consumption going up. Everybody knows what's happening on the roads of China. We saw supply trends, oil prices were peaking. Oil prices were high, production was peaking, probably peaking somewhere between 2000 and 2020's peak production, world oil. Of course, environmental issues that everyone is aware of and security issues. So these kinds of issues pushed us towards an investment in the energy crop sector. Right from the beginning, we flagged a number of species that we wanted to focus on, switchgrass obviously, as most people did at around that time, 2006, sorghum, different kinds of sorghum, miscanthus, and some woody crops. And still today, we play across much of this space. We have had more of a focus in switchgrass than in any of these other species, but today we see greater interest in sorghum, for example, and are working aggressively in it. We deployed our sort of breeding program and our biotech program to these energy crops. The breeding program centered, of course, on the development of markers with which to do accelerating breeding procedures. But the biotech program as well was made use of markers and transformation technology. So at Ceres, we have these two sort of broad streams. Our breeding program is centered in Texas. The biotech piece is centered here in Los Angeles. And we have been pushing them both forward. I'm going to speak today more of the biotech piece and the breeding piece and begin with a question that we addressed about 10 years ago, around the time that we got this company going. How do we find genes that will enhance key traits in agriculture? Then we were thinking of row crop agriculture. But the same thinking applies to the energy crop sector that we address today. At that time, you know, in the late 1990s, very early 2000s, there were not any whole genomes sequenced. So we established a genomics path back then to work on full-length cDNAs. We took a decision to focus our activities on full-length cDNAs. We did this because we knew that if we could become good, you know, world-class, world-beating, at full-length cDNA technology, we could rapidly get complete genome model, complete gene models. We would be able to define what a gene is, transcriptionally and translationally. We would have genes, physical assets, to introduce into plants. cDNAs can be transformed into plants and bring about changes in plant development. Back then, there wasn't very much know-how to how to do all of this stuff. But we did learn early on that computer assemblies of sequence information was not very useful. And it was this difficulty that we and others were finding around assembling, you know, contigs that pushed us in favor of focusing the biotech piece of Ceres around full-length cDNAs. So we went ahead and we started making full-length cDNA libraries from Arabidopsis, corn, soybean, and other species. And we did a lot of QC on these libraries. We, I think, in the early 2000s, probably had world-beating full-length library construction technology. And we did a lot of this over a number of years. Eventually, we gave several thousand full-length Arabidopsis cDNAs to Tiger to annotate the genome right around 2000. Sometime later than that, we put 23,000 full-length cDNAs of corn into GenBank. And beyond that, have developed cDNAs from several species to enable, across the sector, enable comparative genomics. We do comparative genomics with our cDNAs, and others do as well. These full-length cDNAs not only have given us the tools to transform plants, including switchgrass and other energy crops, which I'll show you about in a minute, but when you have a precise cDNA with an exact start codon, it allows you to go upstream and accurately annotate upstream DNA and identify and clone promoters, which can also be used to drive the cDNAs themselves in different kinds of ways. So these were the kinds of things we were doing in the early 2000s. You can see a simple example, a gene that in 1999 probably was annotated at GenBank. We did some sequencing. We found a bunch of new exons in this sequence of this particular gene that was not captured in GenBank. We substantiated the discovery, if you like, of those exons by equivalent sequencing in corn, same gene out of corn, showing the same exons. The identities here are given by the depth of the green boxes. And by using these sort of comparative genomic sequences, we were able to give strength to the argument that some genes in GenBank were misannotated. We reannotated them and helped to compile the existing genome sequence of Arabidopsis. By the mid-2000s, we were doing much the same thing for rice. Here's a GenBank sequence for a rice gene. We sequenced it at Ceres. We found, in this case, another exon. We found the same exon in equivalent sequences out of corn and soybean. And we then helped to annotate the genome of rice. And more recently, we, like everybody else, have moved to next-generation sequencing. And so everybody's doing this, of course, these days, and we do it as well. We've been next-gen sequencing into switchgrass. Probably 100 million sequences now have been aligned, contigged, and used to develop, nice markers, SNP markers, and other kinds of markers out of switchgrass that we have used. The guy that did it is sitting down there. Zhu Feng is sitting down there, who we use to make a number of maps in switchgrass. We had some maps developed as long ago, probably now as 3 years. And so these are the kinds of things we've been doing with gene discovery and gene annotation over the years in different species. So having identified all of these genes, what do we do? Well, we wanted to use as a cornerstone of the Ceres program a gene testing strategy, a transgene-based gene testing strategy that searched for and tested for dominant genes that have large effects. So the Ceres Biotech program is based around transgenes that have big effects, not transgenes that have little effects. The reasons for that will become evident, if not already. You need big effects in something like switchgrass, a very divergent and heterogeneous outbreeding species. If you don't have transgenes that have big effects in switchgrass, very difficult to see them at all because you lose them in the noise that switchgrass gives you as an experimental organism. We selected against transgenes that had sort of negative defects on growth or development or function or yield of one sort or another. We identified and worked with only transgenes that gave phenotypes in multiple events with regular inheritance. We worked in Arabidopsis and then in a monocot. And those days, rice was the most effective transformation system among the monocots, but maybe it's Brachypodium today. And we did all of the rice work in the field. So a combination of all those pieces defined the testing strategy that we put into the gene discovery program at Ceres. And we ran through this gene testing strategy, large numbers of genes, having helped to annotate and describe the Arabidopsis genome, and then the rice genome. We put large numbers of genes through this testing strategy. You can see the left-hand side here, cloning cDNAs of more than 80,000 genes, 10,000 promoters. Many of these things went through into Arabidopsis. We tested them, screened them in Arabidopsis, then in rice, and then we put them in energy crops. So this whole program is what has been the center of the functional sort of biotech activity at Ceres. Approximate numbers, we cloned more than 100,000 full-length cDNAs out of Arabidopsis. These kind of, you know, mapped to about 12,000 different proteins. We put all of those 12,000 proteins as full-length cDNAs through Arabidopsis and screened them for phenotypes in about 40-odd screens. Of those 12,000 genes screened in 40 different ways, we identified about 1,000 genes that had effects on Arabidopsis. Of those 1,000, we've now expressed probably most of them in rice plants in the field. And of those 1,000-odd genes, we've come to about 30 that strike us as potentially valuable in rice plants in the field for the energy crop sector. So that's 30 out of 12,000, and I should tell you, of those 30, probably half of them seem to be more, potentially more valuable than others. So it's about one gene in 1,000 functioning as a transgene that has the regular inheritance, the large effects, the multiple events, and so on, that we think could make these genes valuable in the energy crop sector. It's about one in 1,000. So just a little bit of history. This summarizes probably, 10 years of work and 100 people times 10 years and so on. I mentioned that we'd screened several thousand genes, 12,000 genes for Arabidopsis. This is the kind of thing that we would identify back then. You can see a transgene introduced into Arabidopsis plants on the right-hand side. And compared to a wild type, and these things aren't given any fertilizer, and you can see that this transgene makes the Arabidopsis plants grow bigger and better in low fertilizer conditions. And we know what the gene encodes, so we can conclude that this gene has an effect on nitrogen use. And, you know, so low nitrogen screens are one of our 40-odd screens. Some early flowering, these are really easy. You know, you can find genes that make Arabidopsis plants flower early, and so on. So what I'm not going to do is show you hundreds of pictures of Arabidopsis phenotypes, but, you know, we had about 1,000 phenotypes out of this early program. Put some of these things into rice. You know, here's an early flowering gene in Arabidopsis, and here it is in rice, or an equivalent one. You can see the rice wild-type plants on the left versus the transgenic plants on the right, and these rice plants are the same chronological age. The one on the right is flowering early, it's smaller and flowering early, and the panicle is compacted and so on. So you can see that having identified a bunch of genes that have effects in Arabidopsis, we could introduce them into rice and have a much bigger success rate in rice. Here's one in drought. You know, drought is a little harder to work with, but here's one, you know, not watered. These rice plants are not watered, and the wild type on the left is wilting, and the transgenic plants on the right are not wilting. And it's easy to do these studies in rice when you're armed with genes that you know give drought tolerance in Arabidopsis. To search through rice plants for drought tolerance genes is probably a little bit harder. And so having identified 1,000 genes that do phenotypes and a subset of them that give phenotypes in rice plants as well, we then do large-scale evaluations in China. And here are some, you know, Ceres transgenic seeds being planted in China. And here they are growing, you know, a year later or a season later. And you can see the blocks in the field there. And you can see that this one right here, kind of interesting for biomass, maybe, you know, this may be a biomass. Here's a transgene that makes rice plants bigger than they otherwise would be. And we like these. We don't like these if we're corn breeders, but we like them if we're involved in bioenergy. So you can take those genes out of the ground, those plants out of the ground, and you can. These are plants that are pulled from that plot. In fact, there are a couple of different transgenics represented. You can see each of those transgenes makes these rice plants bigger than wild type, and you can see the earth on the roots there is earth from the ground. And when we take these pictures and measurements, so you put them back in the ground and do field-based measurements and assays. So from all of that, so what did we learn? Well, we learned a number of things. We have a number of genes, obviously, but we learn things on the way. We learned that, by and large, most of the time, transgenes that have an effect in Arabidopsis have a recognizably similar effect in rice. Given that the two plants look different, by and large, it is the case that critical transgenes that have these big effects in Arabidopsis do it as well in rice. The same piece of Arabidopsis DNA introduced into rice will have the same effect in rice that it has in Arabidopsis, more or less. And here's an example. This is a very early example. This was probably the first example that we ever sort of confirmed. You can see the Arabidopsis phenotype on the left and the rice phenotype on the right. And the rice plants, as you go from left to right, are expressing this same transgene, this Arabidopsis gene, at higher and higher levels. So these expression numbers on the top really just tell us that the transgene is being expressed at about 2x normal. First one there, 0.17. Then whatever it is, 5x and 10x normal expression level. So it's Arabidopsis gene expressed at higher and higher levels in rice that makes rice plants shorter and shorter, just as the Arabidopsis gene does in Arabidopsis. So we learned something that wasn't known back then. We learned that these, what we think are important genes, these important regulators of form in Arabidopsis, also regulate form in rice. So that was interesting. We got about 250 of these genes that fall into this category, and if you map them onto the rice chromosomes as alleles that as homologs that have very high levels of identity, you can see that these things are very highly conserved between Arabidopsis and rice. So the Arabidopsis gene functions in rice because the equivalent gene in rice is highly conserved with it. And that picture just shows you those 200 odd genes that have these big effects in Arabidopsis mapped onto the rice genome as rice equivalents. So that's kind of interesting. So, you know, having spent a bunch of money and time identifying these genes, and here's the summary, probably identified 1,000 gene trait associations, genes that enhance pretty well every trait we could identify. Many of these genes are capable of improving each trait, suggesting there's a network of genetic effects underlying each of these traits, obviously. We show there are many steps that can limit a trait. Many of these things are key regulators that are functionally conserved from Arabidopsis to rice. And so, you know, having done all of that, then we wanted to identify promoters with which to drive these genes now in energy crops. So we cloned a bunch of promoters. We tested them in Arabidopsis. Those that express in Arabidopsis, we test them in rice. We find promoters that express in Arabidopsis and rice, and we use those to drive our transgenes in energy crops. And here are some numbers. We tested about 800 promoters. About 200 of those in rice. We're using about 30 of them now, in fact probably even less than that, 15 of them, to drive our top 15 transgenes in energy crops. So we've got about 15 full-length cDNAs and about 15 promoters from this big bunch of work that we use to drive the switchgrass and energy crop program. Here's some examples of promoters. Here's a promoter that induces in droughts. All these plants are transgenic, but the ones on the left are watered and the ones on the right are not watered, so it induces with drought. And this is really an interesting piece. Another thing that we learned is that just like cDNA function, promoter function is conserved across species as well. So here's the same promoter introduced into rice, switchgrass, and miscanthus. It's an early miscanthus picture. I have better ones now. But essentially, this same piece of Arabidopsis promoter DNA introduced into these three species expresses in more or less the same way. So kind of interesting, you know, cDNAs and promoters do it across species. So if, you know, we have now these promoters that address many kinds of cells and different expression levels with conserved functions. So given all of that, then we can do things in energy crops. So here's an example of taking one of those cDNAs and one of those promoters and introducing that combination into switchgrass. So in this case, the cDNA encodes a protein that gives measurable stress tolerance, salt tolerance in this case. So these switchgrass plants are growing in half molar salt, sodium chloride. And you can see the wild type doesn't like half molar salt, but the transgenic one is really fairly blind to it. And the point that I really want to make about this is not that we want to necessarily make salt-tolerant switchgrass, but simply to show that it's very easy then to define phenotypes in switchgrass when you know that the transgenes you're introducing into switchgrass have conserved effects in Arabidopsis and rice. You can expect the same phenotype in switchgrass, right? If it does in Arabidopsis, does in rice, it's probably going to do it in switchgrass as well. And we find that always to be the case. So by basing our gene discovery program around the intersection between Arabidopsis and rice, we gave ourselves strong functional predictive power to bring to switchgrass, which was just as well, because neither we nor anybody else has the capacity to test, you know, hundreds and hundreds of genes in switchgrass and search for phenotypes in switchgrass for the first time. So here's a salt gene in switchgrass that gives salt tolerance in switchgrass. Here's a drought gene in switchgrass. The things on the left are wilting. The ones on the right are not wilting. Here's a drought gene in switchgrass. Now in the field, I have, sorry about the picture, but the wild types on the top there, and you know, in drought conditions, rain-fed conditions in Arizona, are yellow and chlorotic. The transgenics at the bottom are no water, but a green, still growing. So we're able to put out transgenic switchgrass plants into the field now, and we have them growing in several states in the United States, and to demonstrate that these phenotypes hold up in the field as well. So we can kind of short-circuit, you know, we can shortcut, having discovered all of these genes and things in Arabidopsis and rice, we can short-circuit into switchgrass and these big energy crops, get phenotypes very quickly and show that these phenotypes validate in field environments very quickly. If we didn't have this resource, very difficult to get to this kind of picture. If you're starting out with, you know, a genome sequence, very difficult to get to this kind of picture very quickly. And then, of course, we like biomass, and still, as everybody says, you know, the three key traits for the, you know, the bioenergy industry are biomass, biomass, and biomass. And so we have, you know, these some genes now that make switchgrass plants bigger, and you can see here in again, field trial, a gene actually affecting nitrogen. That's why I put the nitrogen picture in earlier on. It's a gene that affects nitrogen assimilation. It encodes an enzyme early in the nitrogen assimilation pathway. It makes Arabidopsis and rice plants bigger in sufficient nitrogen conditions. And here it does in switchgrass as well, bigger in normal fertilizer conditions in the field. And you make lots of events and, you know, you can find typical of, you know, field biology, what typically looks like, lots of transgenic events in the field. The red one in the middle is a control. And you can find a spread of effects within these transgenic events, all containing the same cDNA, but in different positions in the genome. You can find effects, you can find a range of effects, and, you know, here's an outlier that we like this one, obviously, because the control delivers, you know, about 70 units of biomass, and the transgenic, in this case, it's only one event. It's not replicate, it's not, you know, there's no inheritance and no progeny studies yet. Only one event. But nevertheless, it looks like it's sort of two times as big as it would otherwise be. And so, you know, you find this one and then you outcross it, you develop an F1 population, you trial them all over the place, and you try to confirm that this T0 phenotype, this initial transformant phenotype, is a real phenotype that can inherit, and so on and so on. So that's what we've been doing with biomass genes in switchgrass. And so another thing we've learned in this very early slide, not the greatest slide, but it was the first one again. So just as cDNA effects translate from Arabidopsis to rice, they also do it from rice to switchgrass. So here's a cDNA which in rice plants on the left-hand side makes rice plants have more tillers. And it's not the greatest picture, but do the numbers. The same thing in switchgrass, very early example, more tillers in switchgrass. So we learned then from all of this that these, you know, the numbers are screen about 1,000 genes, find about 250 that look like they might be interesting, test the 250 in rice, find a subset that do the same thing in rice and Arabidopsis, put them into switchgrass, and that subset of cDNAs seems to recapitulate functional phenotypes across all three species. So that's how we came upon. So, you know, starting with Arabidopsis, we go into rice, we develop strong predictive power, we put it in NGCrop 1, which for Ceres has been switchgrass, and then according to the learning from switchgrass, then we have total confidence to put those same cDNAs into other NGCrop species as well, and that's what we're currently engaged in. So on top of that then, because we have great confidence in these genes by this stage, we can start combining them, and here's, again, we're back in rice now. But here are two genes we call Y1 and Y2 for shorthand, because they not much use for energy crops necessarily, but for grain crops and row crops could have some value. Y1 and Y2 both increase grain yield in rice. You can see the Y1 phenotype there and the Y2 phenotype. And if we add them together, in this case by combining them genetically, by crossing homozygous Y1 plants with homozygous Y2 plants, you can get these double transgenic plants that add both genetic functions, and you can get these funny little rice plants that actually are really scarcely impaired in yield, grain yield. You still produce quite a lot of grain yield from a rice plant that is much, much smaller than it otherwise would be. It's very interesting, you know, we've learned things from that. We've learned about epistasis among transgenes, and in this case, and in other cases as well, we've learned that it's surprising that it is possible to sustain or even increase grain yield from plants that get smaller and smaller. You would think less leaf surface area and less photosynthesis would result in less grain yield, but we have a number of examples. This may or may not be the best one. We have a number of examples that show that is not the case. You can do away with a good deal of the green tissue in a rice plant and sustain grain yield or even increase it. Kind of an interesting piece of biology. So that's a rapid walk through all the kinds of things we've been doing. All of that stuff intersects with the breeding that we do. This is our breeder in Ceres in Texas, and he breeds switchgrass for various improvements, and we intersect all of those transgenes with his germplasm. So we're about 4 years into this program now. We've been through several breeding cycles in switchgrass. We have a number of transgenes that affect switchgrass. And what's going on today now at Ceres is the intersection of the transgenes and the improved breeding. So we typically, you know what, we typically, when we started this, would observe, I don't know, 5-6 tons of dry matter per acre for switchgrass. We believe that the capacity of switchgrass is far, far greater than that. We think that today's breeding improvements, plus some of those transgenes, could already take us to 12 or 15 dry tons an acre. That's what we're in the business of showing at the moment. And then, as I think I mentioned, become more and more interested in sorghum. You know, sorghum is a spectacular thing for the bioenergy sector. Already some of these things can give 12 or 14 or even 15 dry tons an acre in optimal conditions. So take that and double biomass with one of these genes that doubles biomass. Then suddenly sorghum, which is a rapidly growing annual with a lot of infrastructure and so on and so on, suddenly sorghum becomes a very attractive energy crop. So I think that maybe there's, here's what we're trying to do now with sorghum. You know, so we've been improving biomass sorghums through breeding. We're putting transgenes into biomass sorghums. We have this big sorghum now, it's 18 feet high. And you know, we actually sell it. We sell non-transgenic switchgrass and non-transgenic sorghum into the bioenergy market. So that, I think, is all I've got. That was a very rapid run through of the essentially the biotech program at Ceres as it's developed over the last 10 or 12 years, and one or two of the more interesting things I think we've learned. Thanks.
All right, since we have a few of the remaining speakers here and still some people awake in the audience, what I'd like to do is to bring the speakers out front and for a discussion, any questions, now is the time. If there are no questions for the speakers, we can probably all head down to the poster session.
Yeah.
Oh, there is a question. Okay.
Hi, Christian. I wanted to ask you what you seriously feel is the regulatory environment for transgenic energy.
It's interesting. It's really tight. You know, so we do have permitted trials all over the U.S., but it's not easy, and we have to abide by all kinds of rules and regulations, of course, including spacing 1,000 borders of 1,000 feet, including border rows of sorghum, and most difficult of all, including the forced removal of all panicles at booting. So all of our switchgrass plants in the field have to have their panicles cut off as soon as they emerge. And so, and then, you know, we do pollen flow studies. We try to identify any pollen escapes. We search through neighboring switchgrass plots that we've established to try to capture pollen should it escape. So it was an awful lot. And so the regulatory environment is difficult. I think it's going to remain difficult.
Let me just say, do you think that the first products will be sterile triploids?
Yeah, so at the moment, that is the thinking. Probably the first products are still several years away. So what the regulatory environment will look like in several years, I don't know. But if it looks like today, then indeed these transgenes will only be releasable in some kind of genetically confined environment. So one of the things we're doing, I didn't talk about it, but we've been developing this sort of confinement system where we have two genetic elements in two parents, neither of which gives any kind of phenotype in either of the parents. When you cross them, the two elements combine and you have a sterility phenotype in the F1. So you can do production, you can do improvement, but when you grow these things commercially, you're only growing sterile F1s. So we have two genes that give sterility in Arabidopsis, rice, and switchgrass, and one of them isn't enough. We need two of them because one of them could always falter or silence or something. So you've got to have two of them. You've got to bring two of them together in this sterile F1 and at the same time introduce these trait transgenes as well. So bringing it all together in switchgrass logistically is extremely complex. But there's, you know, aphids are very clear that, they, you know, I go to aphids sometimes and they say, you know, we want two things from you. We want a lot of data about these transgenic plants in the field and we want a sterility system. Now, sorghum's going to be even harder. Yeah. Yeah, essentially so. Essentially, yeah. So we do all of this stuff in China. So, I mean, the detail's a little bit different. It's not 1,000 feet. It's 300 feet or something. And security constraints are different. But essentially, it is the same set of issues. You know, the Chinese, so I interact quite a bit with, the regulators in China as well. And they're very enthusiastic about the future of transgenic agriculture in China, although at the moment is officially still embargoed, officially. They're very enthusiastic about the future of transgenic agriculture, and they're very enthusiastic about the future of liquid biofuels. You know, they, like everybody else, see all of this stuff. They understand what's at stake. The Chinese, for example, are very early thinkers and very early movers in sweet sorghum production for this purpose. But essentially the same set of issues, and we have to manage that as well over there. Please.
I have a more biological question. So very impressive stuff. But cross-species comparison sometimes is, for example, we've done like 7 years ago, 8 years ago in Arizona, we got one of the best plants in water from Hansbrona.
Yeah.
Transform it into Arabidopsis.
Yeah.
Tissue-specific gene expression.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you have the soft condition, that thing is shut down.
Yeah.
And then in our
right.
Thing is innovative. Can you see something?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what we see. And it makes some kind of biological sense, because the higher order regulators of promoter function that give specificity and give, induction properties to the promoter, of course, are going to vary from species to species. So we see something exactly similar. You know, we'll see our promoters that have essentially the same kind of spatial expression pattern, but inducibility issues can vary somewhat between them. So I would say, but even there, they're recognizably similar. A drought promoter, one of our drought promoters, will induce in drought in all species, but the kinetics of the induction, or the strength of the induction, or the specificity of the induction can vary. So it's broadly conserved. Promoter functionality, even at this high level, is broadly conserved, but some of the subtleties can be species specific. You're exactly right. We have information on that subject now for about 15 promoters, and that holds across, I would say, all of them.
Roger, I had a question. On the rice plants where you had the Y1, Y2,
yeah.
Was that at the sort of densities, or was that individual parts?
No, individual parts. Those plants are very, they're not commercial plants. But both the Y1 and Y2 gene, Sarah Shorthand, yield genes, they both increase grain yield, but they make plants a little bit shorter. So you add them both together, and they have a synergistic effect on height. So the plants just get shorter and shorter. And so you can make rice plants that look like turf that are still producing grain. It's really quite extraordinary.
Thank you. Go ahead.
No, nobody knows that. You know, it's extraordinary. Nobody knows that. So one of the things that, coming to Christian's question, APHIS, absolutely demand is somebody's got to figure it out. How long does a switchgrass pollen grain live? How far does it go?
I think anecdotally, not long.
Right. That's good. That's a good start. But nobody knows. Formally, nobody knows. So we have partnerships on this. We have partnerships in Tennessee trying to figure this out. But it's really an important piece of the regulatory environment is to understand that. But honestly, the honest situation is that nobody, not we nor anybody else, can ever formally guarantee that a transgenic pollen grain is not going to escape. Nobody can guarantee that. And so we're trying not to guarantee it. We're trying to argue that we can enfeeble these plants, reproductively enfeeble them such that they would never, never propagate and so on. And the genes themselves have no adverse environmental effects and so on. So we try to argue that. However, APHIS are very, very clear that as things stand today, no genetic confinement system, no product.
You might also check with Ken Vogel if you see him walking around. For all his isolations, and I think some of the work that came out was his predecessor actually had glycerin-coated slides in different areas to see how far it went. But I think the big problem is to find the right set of markers. So you need a plant where it's right to go, and you got to be able to cross it. So who knows?
Yeah.
Okay. Somewhere between 35 to 3,000 feet.
Okay, good. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Roger.